So ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, it's my great pleasure to welcome Professor Arnold Ford with Michael Dicker, the Chair of International Law at the University of Melbourne. She's currently invited professor in Paris 1, where students have had the chance to appreciate the wide range of her competencies, be it in legal theory or in very practical law, I would say, and because she has been teaching about food security and international law. And so Professor Arnold Ford accepted to be our guest for this lecture, which is a joint lecture or a lecture co-organized by the European Society of International Law and the Sorbonne Law School. And Arnold Ford is a specialist in legal theory, beside her abilities in positive law. And that's why she has chosen for this lecture the topic of histories of international law and empire. She's currently editing, together with Professor Florian Hoffmann, an Oxford Handbook of International Legal Theory, which will be an opportunity to promote new reflection in international legal theory. For this lecture, she will speak about, in fact, the main theme of the lecture will be anachronism, and because she will be speaking more about methods and looking more at methods than at contents. So I give her immediately the floor, and of course you will have afterwards the opportunity to ask a question. So Professor Arnold Ford, and it's my pleasure to give you the floor.
So many thanks. It's a great pleasure to be back here in Paris at this very dynamic law school, and I would particularly like to thank Hélène Ruiz-Fabry, my host, for inviting me both to visit at Paris 1 and also for arranging for me to give this lecture. So as she's already prefigured, the lecture focuses on histories of international law and empire, and more particularly on the methodological challenges we face when we write, or indeed when we read, histories of international law and empire. In recent years, we've seen a real expansion of interest and scholarship concerned with the question of whether and of how the imperial past is relevant to thinking about the present of international law and international politics. And we've seen interest in the contemporary relevance of empire fuel new fields of study in world history, in philosophy, politics, post-colonial studies, critical geography, literature, intellectual history, and most importantly for us here tonight, in international law. And indeed, the Sorbonne has been one of the sites of this work on the histories of international law and empire, not only with the work of Professor Emmanuel Joannet on Vattel, but also in the edited volume on imperialism and international law that Emmanuel and Hélène co-edited in 2007, and the new volume that they're co-editing with Marc Tufayan on analysing third world approaches to international law to come out this year. And just next week, we'll see the launch of perhaps the most monumental contribution to this writing of international legal histories, that is the publication of the Oxford Handbook on International Legal History. It's edited by Bardo Fassbender and Anna Petters, and will be launched in Berlin next week. And in their introduction to that handbook, Fassbender and Petters describe their aim of producing a truly global history of international law, one that, they say, will explore the living bond between the past and the present. Now, that interest in and that idea that there's a living bond between the past and the present represents an implicit challenge to the methodological approach that has dominated at least Anglophone intellectual history over the past decades. So you may well be very familiar with this contextualist school of intellectual history that's come out of Cambridge, so it's known as the Cambridge School, associated with Quentin Skinner. And I think this school has really cultivated a sensitivity to anachronism, as one commentator has put it, particularly amongst Anglophone scholars of early modern political thought. So historians influenced by this school argue that past texts must not be approached anachronistically. They say that we shouldn't look to the past with current debates, current concepts, current problems, current vocabularies in our minds, because then we will necessarily misunderstand those past texts that we're reading. And we shouldn't search for the development of canonical ideas or fundamental themes or timeless doctrines. So that's to commit the sin of anachronism. So the clear demarcation that underpins much current historical research requires that everything must be placed in the context of its time, and present-day questions mustn't be allowed to distort that, our sense of that context. So as the critical historian Constantine Fazolt has commented ironically, anachronism is the sin against the Holy Spirit of history. Now, the work of international legal scholars exploring the relation of early modern thinkers to contemporary doctrines has therefore had, as you could imagine, quite an ambivalent reception amongst historians and even legal scholars who ally themselves with this contextualist school. Now, I'm going to discuss that more fully in a minute, but you can get a sense of its tone and its flavour just from one quote from what is actually a series of challenges to international legal scholars by the intellectual historian Ian Hunter. And so Hunter argues that recent critical histories of Gentili, Grotius, Hobbes, Pufendorf and Vattel have, in his words, been dogged by debilitating anachronism and presentism. I think in some ways international lawyers are more vulnerable to such attacks than are legal historians in other fields. So legal historians writing about a famous trial or an eminent jurist writing the new history of the Sorbonne Law School, for instance, rarely face concerted challenges to their methods from scholars in other disciplines. So even if we're all good realists and we all know that legal transcripts or cases are never purely legal, we rarely see legal historians being criticised for exploring the relevance of a past case for present law. They might be criticised for other things, but the idea that we might relate to the past to the present isn't one of them. So after all, as lawyers, we're trained in making meaning move across time. We learn, for example, how to make a plausible argument about why one case should stand as a precedent for a current case, or the reverse, why we should distinguish a past case as having no bearing on the present. I think because international law didn't exist as a discipline as such, or a profession or a set of practices before the mid-19th century, we don't have that kind of uncontested claim to disciplinary ownership of text from earlier periods. So we're thus often seeing a confrontation around this question of method between international lawyers and between thinkers from other fields. So my lecture then is an attempt to work through some of those methodological challenges that we face when we try to write histories of international law and empire. And more particularly, the lecture is a defence of the place of anachronism in international legal thinking. So I want to argue that international legal thinking is necessarily anachronic. Anachronological time. That is, that the operation of modern law is not governed solely by a chronological sense of time in which events and texts are confined to their proper place in a historical progression from then to now. So I want to suggest that if the self-imposed task of today's contextualist historians is to think about concepts in their proper time and place, the task of legal scholars is necessarily to think about how concepts move across time and space. So that doesn't mean being reckless about how concepts move, but nonetheless, it does mean attending to the question of whether and how concepts move across time. So rather than being fixed and immutable, I'm suggesting that the past may be a source of present obligations. And this lecture is then a pursuit of this argument about the anachronic nature of law through an exploration of the particular role in which the past plays in debates about imperialism and its relevance for the present internationalist politics. So in order to pursue this argument about the sense of law's anachronistic quality, my talk this evening will do three things. First, I want to sketch the interrelationship between two figures who are claimed as founding fathers of international law. One is the Dominican theologian Francisco de Vitoria, who lectured at the University of Salamanca in the 16th century. And the other is the American jurist James Brown Scott, perhaps not quite such a canonical figure, unless some of you are the Columbia students visiting in Paris, in which case he may be. So Scott, who was a professor at Columbia, reclaimed Vitoria for international law in the early 20th century. So the relationship between Scott and Vitoria illustrates the concept, the complex and temporally overlapping ways in which I want to suggest lawyers and legal institutions think about past texts and their authors. So first, Vitoria and Scott. Second, I want to suggest that attending to the relation of those two figures challenges the clear separation of past and present that underpins both mainstream international legal doctrine and contextualist historical scholarship. And third, I'll suggest ways in which the relation between Scott and Vitoria illustrates the anachronic or anachronistic quality of law more generally. So to start with Vitoria, I suspect Vitoria needs a little introduction for most of you. Vitoria, with Domingo de Soto, was one of the founders of what we know today as the School of Salamanca, a group of theologians and jurists who taught at the University of Salamanca during the 16th century and whose influence spread throughout Spain and Latin America. And a number of critical legal scholars, including Anthony Angi and Marti Koskenniemi, have recently turned their attention to Vitoria. So the School of Salamanca sought to work within the theological tradition of St. Thomas Aquinas while accommodating the Thomistic genre to the changes wrought both by the emergence of new commercial practices and political forms within Europe and by Spanish imperialist expansion. So for Anglophone international lawyers, Vitoria is best known for the two relaciones, or public lectures, that he gave at Salamanca in January and June 1539. De Indes, Noveter Inventis, or the Indians recently discovered, and De Jure Belli, the law of war. And those lectures were two of the most significant occasions on which Vitoria systematically explored the grounds for the Spanish claim to dominion in the Indies. International lawyers treat these lectures as part of the international legal canon, at least in part due to the efforts of the second founding father I mentioned, James Brown Scott. Or at least, as I said in opening, that's the case for the Anglophone international legal community. So Scott was a major figure in early 20th century American international legal circles, both professionally and academically. According to one of his contemporaries, Scott was a moralist, for whom international law was more than a study or a profession, I'm quoting, it was, in fact, a religion. And Scott had a major influence on the establishment of international law as a professional discipline, in the US and more generally, on the development of new practices of international law for the coming American commercial century, and on the rationalisation of those practices. So Scott was a believer in international arbitration. He was a believer in freedom of trade and navigation. He was a believer in the League of Nations and its new mandate system. And he was a believer in the need to develop former colonial territories. And he played an extremely important role in establishing international law in the US as a profession that was committed to those ends. He also, while a professor at Columbia, instigated the establishment of the American Society of International Law. He established the American Journal of International Law, and he personally funded its first issue. He was a solicitor, a position now called legal advisor, at the US Department of State for 5 years before World War I, and resigned from that office to accept the role of secretary of the newly created Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So that endowment was gifted by the steel baron, Andrew Carnegie, with a budget of $10 million to be used to hasten the abolition of international war. And Scott was also a legal advisor to the American Commission to Negotiate Peace that sailed here to Paris with Woodrow Wilson in 1918. Of particular importance for rationalising these new practices of arbitration, of administration and of free trade was Scott's role as a teacher and scholar. And perhaps his most enduring influence in that role was his editorship of a Carnegie-funded series entitled Classics of International Law. And it was in this series that he was able to express his enthusiasm for Vittoria, to publish the lectures that I've mentioned, and also to write a book himself about the Spanish tradition. In all, 22 titles were published in that series, including treatises by Grotius, Vattel, Vittoria, Suarez, Gentili, Pufendorf, and Wolff. And in a letter explaining why the Carnegie Endowment should continue publishing this series after World War I, Scott explained his sense of its importance in these terms. International law as a system will survive the calamitous and brutal war of 1914, but it will be shattered in the conflict, and many of its provisions will be bruised if not destroyed. The general public appears to regard international law as a modern invention and looks to the Hague Conventions as the source of its authority. So, says Scott, it's especially important at this juncture that the general public should know and that the professors and students of international law should be in a position to make it clear that international law is not a thing of convention and compromise, but the slow and painful outgrowth of centuries in response to the needs of nations and people. And he said, while those people are distant in space and in thought, they must have dealings one with the other and must have those dealings conformed to law if justice and its perfected fruit, peace, is ever to prevail. So we can hear there an argument for law as something other than purely chronological. Law is something that doesn't simply derive its authority from the process of negotiation, that's not simply the stuff of convention, but that can find its origins through the slow and painful outgrowth of centuries. Vittoria for Scott was a liberal and he was a humanist. So Scott reads Vittoria as a liberal and a humanist. He welcomes Vittoria's thinking on the need for trade and navigation, and he welcomes Vittoria's thinking on the need to educate the Indians so that, in his words, they should be fitted to enjoy the rights of all human beings, as well as subjected to their duties. So as Anthony Anghie has pointed out, this invocation of Vittoria by Scott plays a central role in legitimating the creation of a new form of international law for a new American century. As Anghie has argued, the structure of ideas that shapes these lectures, published by Carnegie, offers a prelude to the grand redeeming project of bestowing sovereignty through decolonization that the US would take upon itself in the 20th century. By opening his reading of Vittoria with a reference to the inclusion of Vittoria's Relationes in the Carnegie Classics of International Law series, Anghie demonstrates that we should understand Vittoria's relevance by placing him in a new series, or to use the language of the Skinner School, in a new context. And the context in which we should place him is this new American century that places commerce at the centre of international law, that's concerned with the relation between the protection of property and the resort to war, and that's concerned with the liberation, the transformation, and the humanitarian interventions in the decolonized world. So I'd like to conclude that introduction to the reception of Vittoria by recounting an anecdote which involves the painting of a series of murals to decorate the newly built Department of Justice in Washington in 1935. So in the mid-1920s, the US government began construction of a series of federal buildings in the middle of Washington, one of which was the new headquarters, indeed the first building to house the Attorney General and the Department of Justice. And when the new headquarters was completed in 1935, it was decided to adorn the ceremonial entrance with a series of mural panels depicting the great lawgivers of history. So it moved from early Egyptian kings through the figures of successive epochs to the present age. But the artist who was painting the mural was unable to locate a likeness from which to paint the features of Vittoria. So there were no cameras recording Vittoria's lectures, malheureusement, because we'd all like to look that up on YouTube. So instead, hearing of Dr. Scott's work, the artist sought Scott's advice on how where he might find a portrait of Vittoria. Unfortunately, Scott had to tell him that there was no portrait of Vittoria in existence. So in a lengthy tribute to Scott published in the American Journal of International Law after his death in 1943, a colleague recounts how this then worked out. So the artist returned to his mural and painted the figure of Vittoria, garbed, true to life, as a Dominican friar, but with an excellent likeness of the head and hands of James Brown Scott. So there in the halls of justice at Washington, standing among the great lawgivers of the world, opposite Hugo Grotius, is a good picture of Dr. James Brown Scott, disguised in the clothes of a Dominican theologian, expounding the law of nations 100 years before Grotius. Now, that image of the likeness of Scott in the guise of Vittoria, adorning the entrance of the US Department of Justice, is a very eloquent one. And in the remainder of my talk, I want to suggest two things I think it tells us about the character of modern law. First, the composite Vittoria Scott figure suggests a relationship between international law and the past that is counter to the sense that the past and the present are clearly demarcated. Second, the place of the Vittoria Scott figure in the mural at the entrance of the Department of Justice also illustrates the anachronistic nature of modern law more generally. So I'd like to say something first about what it says about international law in the imperial past, and second, something of what it says about anachronism and law more broadly. So first, the relation between international law and empire. As I commented in opening, there is a renewed interest today, both within and outside the academy, in the question of whether and how the imperial past is relevant to the law and politics of the present. And in the field of international law, I think this return to empire is one expression of a dissatisfaction with the idea that decolonization successfully and somehow completely took place in the 1950s and 60s, that international law and institutions are essentially today free of any colonial structures or concepts, and that the political question now is how to mobilise what has become a truly universal law. So many critical international legal scholars, a number of them associated with the Third World Approaches to International Law, or TWAIL movement that Alain brought to Paris a number of years ago, have argued against this forgetting of the past of international law. So this group of scholars have asserted or argued that imperialism must still be thought of as part of international law. So the question is how we understand that ongoing relationship. And the stakes of that debate, it seems to me, are quite high. Because much of the authority of modern international law rests on its claim to have transcended its European heritage and to operate today as a universal law that can represent humanity. And we only have to look at the documents of the Rio Plus 20 conference, the Millennium Declaration, many iconic recent statements which have this appeal to some sense of a universal humanity at their heart. So the suggestion that international law may operate in a differentiated fashion then is an important challenge to that claim. So that's one of the stakes of this debate. In addition, the idea that the history of imperialism is of no relevance to the contemporary global order plays a part in justifying the status quo. So if one argues that current extremes of uneven development or the mass movement of peoples or food insecurity or poverty are the consequence essentially of policies adopted in the decolonised world over the past 30 years rather than some longer history, then our sense of responsibility for those problems, of course, shifts. So the stakes here then involve analysing a possible continuity between an imperial past and a multinational present versus searching for more expansive legal bases to educate or improve the peoples of the decolonised world. Now, that idea that the past has no bearing on the present is, I think, deeply ingrained in Western thinking. So this is the sense of time that I'm talking about, a sense of time in which we in the present have the capacity and indeed the responsibility to create societies or laws or institutions that are free from the constraints of the past. So unlike our medieval ancestors, who I feel I'm living amongst on Rue Tournefort, we're not hampered by the illusion that destiny limits our freedom to bring new worlds into being. So the legislators and the modernisers of the present are not bound by ancestral traditions or archaic obligations. We might choose to be bound by ancestral traditions, but that's our choice. We're free in time to make that decision. So as Constantin Fasolt puts this, the occupants of the modern world could not imagine life if our present were cluttered by the laws of ancient Rome, the science of Aristotle, and the morals of Saint Augustine. We moderns are free to change the present into the form we desire for the future we want. So just as modernizers believe that the past has no claim upon the present, so, too, many historians, as I've said, argue that the present should have no claims upon the past. And I've pointed to the contextualist school of the Cambridge historians for a really strong example of this tendency in much contemporary Anglophone history of political thought. So on the one hand, while the turn to history in international legal scholarship has been celebrated to a degree, on the other hand, historians have quite sternly cautioned international lawyers against adopting this anachronistic approach to history. And they argue that the history of international law has suffered from the pragmatic interest that we international lawyers take when we look at history. So according to Randall Lessifer, an international legal historian, the aim of the work of much international lawyers is not to understand what happened in the past, but to give current ideas or practices roots in the past. And this kind of historiography, says Lessifer, sins against the most basic rules of historical methodology, and the results are deplorable. I'm still quoting, "This genealogic history from present to past leads to anachronistic interpretations of historical phenomena, clouds historical realities that bear no fruit in our own times, and gives no information about the historical context of the phenomena one claims to recognise." So that approach to history, of course, hasn't gone unchallenged. The approach to interpreting past events or texts only in the context of their time has been challenged, both from within the world of practicing historians, Fazolt would be one example, and from more philosophically oriented scholarship. Michel Foucault would be an example there. So to take one example from the world of practicing historians, Francis Oakley has questioned the idea that the context shaping linguistic conventions can be confined to one that's contemporaneous with the lifetime of the author under scrutiny. So in a book beautifully entitled Politics and Eternity, Oakley says, "Scholars being people of the book may have often more in common, both intellectually and in terms of linguistic conventions followed, with writers of the past than with many of their contemporaries." And Oakley says it's essential to recognise the degree to which the authors whose texts are to be interpreted often inhabit a world peopled through books with the dead. To take an example of the philosophical challenge to the clear demarcation between past and present in the work of Foucault, Foucault's claim to be writing a history of the present famously was, I think, a full-scale assault on this idea that history could, or indeed should, be written from a point of view other than the present. So international lawyers are extremely adept at thinking critically about the claim that we modern sovereign peoples are free in space. So we're very good at making the argument that states can't be free from external obligations. But we're less ready with critical responses to the claim that we have sovereign freedom in time. We're much more likely to accept this idea that we're free from the past. And it's here, I think, that we can see the significance of scholarship that rejects the view, in the words of Angie, that colonialism was an unfortunate but perhaps necessary historical episode whose effects have now largely been reversed. Instead, critical scholars have argued that imperialism has structured international law in quite foundational ways, and that justice can only be achieved in the present by continuing to interrogate the ways in which that past continues to bear on legal questions of our time. The image of the composite Victoria Scott figure also provides a useful illustration of the challenge that law poses to chronological thinking more generally. So many historians have responded critically to the work done by international legal scholars revisiting the importance of figures such as Victoria or Vattel or Grotius. So historians have dismissed recent readings by international lawyers for assuming, I'm quoting, a false continuity and connectedness between Victoria and the contemporary discipline of international law, or for taking, again I'm quoting, daring jumps that destroy the complexity and pluralism of the discourses from divergent centuries. And as I mentioned in opening, in a sustained series of critical responses to Angie and other scholars of international law, Ian Hunter has argued that Angie tries and fails to establish that extra-European colonialism provided the unifying ideological essence during the classical age of empire. So for Hunter, the argument that natural law and jus gentium played this kind of role is itself an anachronistic one. It's imposing a false vision of the unity of natural law back into earlier centuries. But if we look to the context in which Victoria was reclaimed for modern American international law, we can see that Ange hasn't invented a project of modern internationalism that he's then anachronistically projecting back onto Victoria. Rather, early modern jus gentium has been systematically and carefully reconstructed in the US at the dawn of the 20th century to make sense of practices and institutions that were already reshaping the world. So Ange was not, in other words, trying and failing to create a connection between Victoria and 17th century colonialism, but rather he was creating a new context within which to understand the relevance of Victoria today. And that context is the one in which Scott recovered Victoria, a context of free trade, of liberalised economies, of informal empire, and of benevolent humanitarianism. So Victoria's theses do bear an ambiguous relationship to classical European colonialism, but so does the 20th century form of multilateralism and private ordering. And indeed, that's the point. Victoria's humanitarian critique of Spanish empire was invoked by ideological innovators, to use a Cambridge School term, such as James Brown Scott, to provide a language for rationalising these new forms of international action. So, of course, the political theorist Richard Tuck, in his book The Rights of War and Peace, is right to say that the first generation of legal scholars who systematically looked at the early modern jurisprudence of war, that is Scott and his colleagues, left us with a misleading picture. So Tuck says, Scott and his colleagues approached Victoria and Gentili and Vattel as if they were trying and failing to clarify some inchoate principles of international law, and as if they had a common aim. And Tuck says, many historians of a discipline make this mistake and assume that their discipline was somehow waiting to be uncovered back in the Middle Ages, and that those early figures just got this wrong. So Tuck's not wrong to make that argument, but rather the point I'm trying to make is that as the heirs of both Victoria and Scott, we can't ignore the fact that Scott and his generation did successfully weave Victoria and Gentili and Grotius and Vattel into a universal history with a cosmopolitan purpose. So in so doing, they and their colleagues and fellow travellers have remade the world in their image. And unless we remember that history of the 20th century, we can't understand the claims made by international legal doctrines and declarations today, with their vision of a common humanity inspired by timeless and universal principles and committed to establishing a just and lasting peace all over the world. I'm quoting there, not Victoria, not Scott, but the Millennium Declaration. Yet unless we remember the histories of earlier centuries, we can't understand the potential dangers inherent in such visions either. So we need to remember both histories, the history of the 20th century that got it so wrong and the history of the earlier centuries in which these ideas were first developed. So attention to the ways in which law as ideological innovation involves the movement of concepts across time and place thus poses a broader challenge to the idea of the past as history. According to Fassolt, the invention of history amounted to a declaration of independence from the authority of ancient texts. Early modern political thinkers sought to distinguish between law and history, between real modern law and false medieval law, between real lawyers and historians of law. And I gather that in France you put those people in different departments. So, well, in Australia we would have them together still in a law school. So real law was defined by presence, and history, on the other hand, belongs in the past. But where the boundary between history and law ought to be drawn is fundamentally disputed. For lawyers, I think, the past can't be forgotten. Law is a site not only for the creation of new obligations, but also for the transmission of inherited obligations. Law is inherently genealogical, depending as it does upon the movement of concepts, languages, and norms across space and even time. So the past, far from being gone, is constantly being retrieved as a source or rationalization of present obligation. So while some legal historians identify as historians and preach against the sin of anachronism, in a sense lawyers are and must be sinners in that sense. Law necessarily has to reckon with obligations that are not derived solely from the current rulers of a state. And in that sense, whatever the felt urgency of breaking with the past persists in custom, in precedent, and in legal tradition. So to conclude, in their book Anachronic Renaissance, Christopher Wood and Alexander Nagel sought to contest the chronological base of the discipline of art history and its aversion to anachronism. For Wood and Nagel, art was the name given during the Renaissance to something that could hold together two ideas about time. On the one hand, the work of art was a material object, an object with a history that had been created by identifiable human agents. But on the other hand, the work of art was a relic, in the religious sense, a magical conduit to other times and places. So art had the ability both to gesture towards the historical world in which it had been created and also to gesture beyond that world to symbolise realities unknown to its makers. And it was in the latter sense that Renaissance art was anachronic, other to the notion of chronological time flowing steadily from before to after, that was then gaining the upper hand, and that was, as I have suggested, necessary to the emergence of the modern state. So for Wood and Nagel, art is the name of the possibility of a conversation across time. And I would suggest that law is another name for that possibility. Law, like art, holds together two ideas about time. In the modern state, the authority of law, like art, derives from its relation to human acts of creation, to human identifiable sources. We look for human sources of law, and we're no longer impressed by the claim that law is something that can be assembled from canon law, natural law, custom, tradition, or moral standards by a group of erudite men. So in that sense, we're all contextualists now. Yet law, like art, loses its aura if it's completely reduced to human proportions. So we create buildings, departments of justice, artifacts, murals, and even texts to embody institutions. And the power of such creations requires that they resist anchoring in time. So to return to the words of James Brown Scott, it's especially important at this juncture that the general public should know that international law is not a thing of convention and of compromise to be found in treatises of recent date, but that it is the slow and painful outgrowth of centuries. So it's fitting then that the entrance of the US Department of Justice displays a likeness of Scott in the guise of Vittoria, because it's the version of Vittoria created by Scott that would provide the origin and thus the ideological justification for the universal law of the American century. The Vittoria who was reclaimed for 20th century international law arrived between the covers of a book emblazoned with the name of one of the richest industrialists of the 19th century in a series edited by one of the most influential American international lawyers and moralists of the early 20th. Scott introduced his fellow Americans to Vittoria as the father of a new kind of international law for a new kind of world order. And it's this world order that scholars of international law and empire have sought to understand and to critique. Thanks.
So you spoke, we had a chat before the lecture, I have to confess, and we chatted precisely about this anachronism and this idea to know whether, due to anachronism, we don't understand what happened in the past. And we had discussion about this idea that we're not sure that we understand well what happened in the past, but I answered that in my view, we don't know if we don't understand. I mean, this is the optimistic interpretation. What is your view?
So, Hélène, in discussion beforehand, it's always nice to prefigure your question, your first question, raised the point that this is very much like a discussion also that goes on within comparative law, the idea that we can't understand the law of another place, we can't understand the law of another time, and then the pessimistic view being, well, then we should stop trying because we don't know whether we understand. And so Hélène's view is, well, we also don't know whether we misunderstand. Maybe we've got it right, so let's be optimistic and keep going. So my interest here is not to say, I think, that the contextualist school have led us astray. So it's hugely interesting to try and attend carefully to how a scholar or an author was trying to intervene in debates, whether those debates were ones they were having in their head with dead people or ones they were having with people in the room, and what they were trying to make their texts do. Lawyers, I think, are very good at thinking like that because we think of language as something very active. So my sense is precisely that I don't want to give up on the very strong attempt to engage properly with this kind of contextualist method. On the other hand, I would really want to activate the sense of context and to say, as I've tried to say in the talk, that I think as lawyers, the context is really something that's very much open to be questioned, and particularly as international lawyers. So the context of a discussion about a particular topic may be a legal case that's arising in Australia, but that will necessarily be in conversation with discussions that are happening in other countries, with ideas that have been drawn in from history. As lawyers, that's what we're trying to activate, is that sense of context. So this is why I'm stressing two ideas of time, that law both is attentive to this question of human creation, but also looking for the ways in which these ideas gesture out to something beyond that moment of creation.
Have a question? You have to wait for the mic. It's coming. And just introduce yourself, please, so that I can
know. My name is Hélène Dubotnet. And I would like to ask you if your method has practical implication in the application of international law today. Do you have an example where your method can change the result?
That's an interesting question. We use ideas about history and responsibility, I think, all the time in international law. We use ideas about what period of time is relevant to thinking about a particular situation, a particular legal question. We do that as a matter of course. So in some ways, thinking about time like this wouldn't be news to practicing lawyers. I think that's something that lawyers, as I've tried to draw out, I think that is something that's already part of legal method. So really, in a sense, what I'm trying to do here is engage a debate, an interdisciplinary debate, about this history and its implications for contemporary law. So I'm trying to say that historians have a responsibility for how they think about law, just as lawyers have a responsibility for how we think about history. But I would say that how we think about the relation of questions of responsibility and justice to history is enormously important in all fields of law. So how we understand responsibility for a particular situation of civil war, how we understand responsibility for human rights violations, how we understand responsibility for climate change, how we understand the structures of international trade, and whether or not we should worry that they reproduce structures we see in earlier centuries. All those questions necessarily involve thinking about responsibility across time, as well as responsibility in the present. There's also someone at the back.
My name is Jennifer Gold, I'm also a PhD student. I just have a question connected to this one. You see, do you think that maybe we can find some kind of cyclical repetition of things in history so that you can kind of see what will happen if you engage in a certain way of anything in international?
It's a really interesting question, and one that I think about often. So, it's very interesting to wonder whether concepts bring with them other kinds of historical baggage. So I've been doing work recently on the responsibility to protect concept. And one of the things that's very interesting about that concept is how it radicalizes notions of authority, how it brings a way of a jurisprudence of war into the civil context, and how we can see it doing that from already the 17th century. So then, is it that the concept somehow imports with it a set of ways of thinking that shape how we understand situations, or is it far less determined than that? You know, in some ways I think there's elements of both of those things going on. I think concepts do bring with them in some ways structures of thinking, but of course that remains very open, and where a concept will lead us is always still a political question, is still a very active question. You can see I haven't totally bought out of the idea that we're free to choose our destiny.
Thank you. My name is Muhammad Amr. First of all, thank you for the presentation. And I would like to ask two questions. And my background is law, I'm a lawyer, so that's why it might be a bit different from the approach. First of all, the relationship between the history and the international. The question here is, do you see that the rules of international law has the same value and respect and re-implemented by the North same way as by the South? We know that the international law was created originally in the North. So how do you see the application or the implementation of international law rules from North to the South? I think the value of the rules of international law and how it's applied in the North has different perspective than what we apply in the South. And if we go to the International Court of Justice and the cases before the International Court of Justice, this can also show us how the states for the most part rely on the international law in settlement of disputes, which is not the case usually in the South. This is one question. The second question I have is related to the obligations created in the past. And this nowadays we face a new problem that many states reject to apply the international treaties concluded whether 100 years ago, or they claim that this was these agreements were concluded or treaties concluded at the time when they were under colony. And they reject to apply, despite that we have the Vienna Convention and so on, but they resist the application, saying this is a historical obligation which we don't recognize anymore based on the treaty. However, the others say that this is legal obligations should be respected. If this is the case, to be referred to international tribunal, for instance, mean, will the international tribunals recognize these treaties as conventions and then apply it on the first, on both parties, or say that this is an old-fashioned treaties or obligations and that's why we will not apply it? Thank you very much.
Many thanks. A lot of issues raised in your question, so maybe I'll just take a couple of points for now, and perhaps we could talk more later. So one reaction I would have is partly that I wouldn't want to make a strong statement about the North versus the South in terms of responses to international law. It seems to me that that's perhaps a bit too cut and dried to think just in terms of North-South and some kind of clear division. For instance, we would be there have been periods in recent years where there's been a great deal of concern in the North about whether the US, for instance, was interested in complying with international law, with other states within the North taking different positions, and we would see similar, of course, differences between states in the South. I would say that there's a very interesting period that I think would deserve some more attention, and that is the period immediately after decolonization in the 60s, in the early 70s, where we can see a debate that I think could do with some revival, really, about what decolonization meant for international law. So an extremely good faith debate coming out of the Third World. I'm thinking about R.P. Anand, scholars like that in India. I'm thinking about judgments of the ICJ. But I'm also thinking about the involvement of lawyers from the US and from Europe in discussions about what decolonization, how radical decolonization was and what it meant, what it could mean, what it had to mean in international law for it to have any significance. And I was recently reading around the Vietnam War for an article that's about to come out in a special issue of the European Journal of International Law that's devoted to Michael Voltzer's Just and Unjust Wars. And I was interested because Voltzer says there he's against international law and international lawyers are living in a paper world, and he's against legalism and he's for moral approaches to international questions. So I thought, what were international lawyers saying at the time that would have Voltzer reacting like this? Well, actually, international lawyers weren't doing anything of the sort. What's very interesting in the pages of the American Journal in the 60s and 70s is of the British Yearbook and various other major Anglophone journals at the time, is this real attempt to think about what international law, what was required of it in terms of renovation to come to terms with decolonization. That seems to me a debate that's really passed, perhaps partly because of disenchantment with the International Court of Justice and disenchantment with the turning away from the General Assembly. But I think there's nothing like that debate really in the mainstream of those journals anymore. So I would say I don't see a strong distinction in approaches to international law, but something of the good faith, perhaps the naivety of that early discussion, seems to me to have left the scene.
Thank you, Professor. I missed the speech, so I don't know what you said. But I had a question regarding this issue of empire and international law. You know, we have colonialization, we have imperialization, and we feel like we're in a stage after that. But what we see in a lot of different areas is the current international law regime in some ways is structuring the way a certain interest is retained by the dominant powers in place. And one key area that seems to get a lot of scholarship these days is sovereignty, and how sovereignty is a thing of the past. And Lori Dambush from Columbia University told us that all the scholars are pushing international law in this direction, type of discussion, and we see that from the right to protect, dealing with internal affairs of other countries, and the divide we see. Do you feel like this international law system that, you know, has been invested in for so long to develop, is it going in a direction that at some point states will react negatively to and try to and go towards a restructuring of the system? Or do you see it will be basically a system that it will be applied in parts of the world and some independent states, if their power and stability allows them to, would just try to stay out?
Thank you, Ramin, who may have missed the lecture but has been attending my classes, I'll take the point as coming out of that broader discussion in any case. That's, again, it's such a huge question, and can I predict whether the system will disintegrate? But let's, maybe if I just stay with the question of sovereignty and its position in the system. I think that I would absolutely agree that we've seen over the past decades fairly systematic turn away from an interest in questions of the subject of international law status and questions of sovereignty towards much more functionalist accounts of international law. So the responsibility to protect concept is in some ways a reaction to that, or in some ways, you know, the end point of that, in that we've seen the argument made by the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty that put forward the responsibility to protect idea, that sovereignty is a set of functions that can be disaggregated, a bit like departments in an enterprise, in a corporation. So if somebody isn't performing their function well, you can just allocate that function to someone else. And behind that idea, it's always that there's some manager who can decide who could best exercise a function. So if a state can't exercise its responsibility to protect, then that function should just be allocated to someone else to do. As if this was just a question of administration that didn't involve politics. I think what's quite interesting with the responsibility to protect concept is politics comes back in the question of who decides. Who decides what protection means and who can offer it. In the case of international economic law, which is what I'm talking about in the classes here, we've been looking at food sovereignty, questions of intellectual property, questions of land acquisition and biofuels. And again, I think it's very interesting that what seemed to have been sorted out as a kind of technical issue has now led to a Doha round of negotiations that are completely stalled over attempts by partly developing countries to reassert questions of sovereignty. Countries reasserting questions of sovereignty and failing before the WTO appellate body itself, for instance, in China's case, attempting to reassert the doctrine of permanent sovereignty over natural resources and failing. But nonetheless, in negotiations, we're seeing these ideas still very much being held onto. So I don't think sovereignty is disappearing, but I think it's true that there's been a period in international law where it's been seen, and I'm quoting, as anachronistic.
Hello, I'm Shirin Foti. I was wondering whether in your research on this this particular topic that you lectured on, whether you have seen any parallels with, for example, in domestic situations in national law, with ideas of constitutional law between textualism and more kind of contextualized approach of looking at issues. I'm thinking in one case, for example, of affirmative action in the United States and incorporating race into the analysis of the Supreme Court. But I'm not sure if you've seen that in other contexts or specifically in other maybe common law jurisdictions.
So it's a great question. It's not my field, but I did give a talk at the Australia and New Zealand Law and History meeting along these lines at the end of last year. And there were a lot of law and historians from different fields. And absolutely, including some who come from the US, and there the debate, of course, is a really lively one, exactly around this question of presentism and how you interpret legal concepts, and indeed, can legal concepts move across time and space, including their scholars who've done important work on habeas corpus, for instance, and the history of that concept. So I think there are very live debates in terms of
because it's constitutional law around these questions. In Australia, and I'm sure in any system that's dealing with the legacies of colonialism, we also see enormously heated debates around questions of law and history. So whether and how the history of colonialism should shape approaches and directions that either the High Court or the legislature take is a hugely contested question. So obviously, empire is going to be one of those fault lines that bring this question to the fore.
Hello, my name is Manuel Castellarna. I'm also a PhD student here. I have two questions. The first one is about Victorian Scots, and the second one is about imperialism and international law, and imperialist heritage and international law. If we turn to Scots and Victoria, what they have in common is, in fact, that they both are linked to the tradition of natural law, which by definition consists in thinking that law is anachronistic because it's natural, because it's rational, because it's necessary. So, in the end, this example of Victorian Scots, doesn't it show that law is anachronistic if you believe so? That's the first question. And the second question is about imperialism, which has a sociological element, and a sociological element consisting in substantial inequality between the entities of the empire, and a legal element consisting of formal inequality between those entities. Shouldn't we take this into account, this difference between sociological facts and the legal issue into account when we talk about the imperialist heritage in international law?
Great. So on the first point, absolutely. Right, that both Victoria and Scott are within a natural law tradition, and that we should take that into account when we're thinking about that example. And indeed, I think it's very interesting to think about the place of natural law in very dogmatic or very positivist traditions, yours and mine, because of the role that a much more contextualist approach, in a sense, plays to justifying the law in those kinds of systems. But then you say, isn't law anachronistic if we believe it to be so? And I suppose the point I'm making there is that in a sense, international law retains that foundation in natural law. So we believe it to be so. That's the point I'm trying to make. And then what flows from that? Well, good things and bad things. But I think that theological tradition is really at the heart of this way of thinking about law. And that's part of its appeal for me, but also part of what can make it quite dangerous. Perhaps that's why I'm holding on to both of those ideas. In terms of sociological facts, and indeed juridical facts, then I would be wanting to ask a lot more questions. So this is really a starting point for a set of questions about, yes, what do we see persisting as legal structures from the imperial past, and what do we see as moving? Now, you're looking at the question of formal equality, and of course that's one we could focus upon, and that's one that we would say has changed largely. But we might want to look at other ways in which law helped to structure or enable imperialism, and we might find that some of those persist. So the question is indeed an empirical one. I wouldn't answer it as quickly as by saying formal equality resolves the question, but I would agree with you that it's a question, an empirical question.
So it's time now to thank very much Anofa for this very exciting and interesting lecture. I hope you share my enthusiasm, because it will be put on the internet, and people interested in going on to debate with you or can be invited to do so, but to close the stage now. Thank you very much.